What is hitting you in the pocketbook? We'll find out because it is time for On Your Money. Your financial questions are front and center as Kevin McKinley is here. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Good morning, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
All right. And Kevin is ready to take your financial questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post your questions for Kevin on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin, the economy is up. Unemployment is down. Profits are doing quite well. Why then aren't workers getting raises?
Well, they're actually doing okay. The average hourly pay, according to the BLS and the most recent figures for private sector workers, is $26.25 per hour. And for the average full-time worker, that works out to weekly earnings of about $905, which is $47,000 per year. But as you mentioned, we've had 82 straight months of job growth, and unemployment is now at 4.4%. That's down from 10% in October of 2009, even though more people in recent months have come back into the workforce, meaning they're looking for jobs, which that tends to kind of push up the unemployment numbers, because when they're measuring unemployment, if someone says, I'm not looking for a job, they don't count them as unemployed, even though they might not have one.
But wages still aren't rising.
Not much, and not until recently. That number of $26.25 is up 60 cents over a year ago, about 2.5%. And inflation is about 2% or so, as the Consumer Price Index measures it. But workers became accustomed to rising wages before the recession of 2009 of 3 to 3.5%. Doesn't sound like much, but in the aggregate, it means an awful lot of money that was going into workers' hands and is not right now. Plus, many workers are paying more for their benefits as a percentage of their paycheck, specifically their health insurance. Their premiums are higher, their deductibles are higher, and so therefore they're netting less out, even though they've gotten a slight bump up in wages.
Then what specifically is the reason why employers are not handing out those raises?
Specifically, it's lots of things. one of the reasons why they're feeling the pain so much is because the inflation for needs are very high. That's healthcare, education, housing, and food. It's the inflation for wants, like electronics or other goods that is either flat or down. The inflation, though, is low for a lot of companies, and companies can't push through sales increases, revenue increases, and they're very concerned that if they do try to push those through, they'll lose business. And even if they try to bump up wages for their workers, they're very reticent to do so because it's very difficult for workers to take cuts in pay to stay on the job if and when times get tough again. During the last recession, employers were more likely to keep pay stable for remaining employees, but lay off workers due to economic situations. And the workers themselves bear a little bit of the responsibility because they don't want to risk upsetting their employer. They're still happy to have a job. And rather than try to go in and get an extra dollar or two more per hour, they say, no, I'm just going to stick with what I have. And then there's uncertainty. The employers are worried about trying to bump up wages and then only having to cut them back. Workers are happy with the job. And then union membership has a big component of this. In 1973, the workforce, about 25% of the full-time workers were in unions, and that's down to just a little over 6% right now for 2016.
Well, when you look in your crystal ball, Kevin, will wages eventually rise? Will they get a boost?
Probably, and at least a little over the next 6 to 12 months or so. But the problem is that wages are actually the last thing to rise in a typical economic cycle, because first of all, people are just happy to have a job, and then they're just happy to get hired if they do enter the workforce. And so the wages and increasing is usually the last thing to go. And because we are so long into the economic cycle, about an 8.5-year boom, this is typically the time when workers do see some wage increase for it. But one thing people might see is that employers are trying to maintain more flexibility. So they might say, look, we're not going to give you a raise. We will give you some kind of bonus this year or some kind of extra perk, so that it's something that you don't become accustomed to, that if we have to take it away next year, it won't be as disappointing for you. But next week, we will talk to you about how you can increase your earnings in your current job.
Kevin McKinley is with us. He's managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And with that, let's take a call now. Kathy in Fountain City. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've got a rollover IRA that's like $33,000, and all 100% of it is in fixed income funds. And I was wondering if maybe there were, had any opinion on what might be better to put it in.
Look, Kathy, there's probably two ways to go with this, and I'm not a huge fan of having a large portion of a person's assets in fixed income mutual funds because there's very little potential reward with it. Generally, in a time of low interest rates, there's not much upside left for bonds to appreciate, and if interest rates do rise, or if the economy gets worse, or both, fixed income funds tend to get hit pretty hard compared to their potential reward. So, if you're a very conservative investor, I'd rather have you just put that in CDs at your local bank or credit union. You can shop around online because at least you're going to get a similar yield of 2% if you go out longer. But you're going to have the security of FDIC insurance plus the knowledge you're going to get the same interest check every single year. And if you need to get the money out of that CD early, there's usually a small penalty for early withdrawal. If you say that, no, this is growth money, I'm comfortable with taking on risk because I'd like this to hopefully be worth a lot more when I actually do retire, then you should look at the stock market because, in my opinion, even though the stock market has more risk than bond funds or fixed income funds do, there's also more potential long-term reward there. And sometimes, Kathy, a strategy, I can't say for sure if it's right for you, but sometimes a strategy you might want to look at is maybe putting half and half between the stock market, like on a Vanguard index fund or something like that, and then certificates of deposit. So on one, you've got one half of the portfolio is very boring. It's not going to make you much, but it's not going to lose much. On the other hand, you've got a little volatility, a little excitement, if you will, in the stock market fund, and that's going to give you, over the long term, probably greater return than the fixed income fund will.
Kathy, thanks so much for calling in. We appreciate it. Kevin, with some stock market indicators marking new all-time highs, we've had a couple of questions on how to sell stocks and stock mutual funds without having to pay a lot of capital gains taxes. What do you say?
It's a good problem to have. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. If you're paying capital gains taxes, something has gone right for your investments. Now, this, of course, is for investments that are held outside of retirement accounts like IRAs or 401ks or 403bs or other ones like annuities. And typically, if you hold an investment for less than a year and then you sell it, the short-term capital gains tax rate is equal to your income tax rate, which can be 25 to almost 40% once you get separate add-ons and surcharges on top of it. Generally, if you are looking at the long-term capital gains tax rate, it's usually around 15% or so on a federal basis at the most.
So how can investors avoid or at least reduce these taxes?
We get a lot of complaints from people say, gosh, I've got so many capital gains. If I sell it, I'm going to have taxes from listeners, from our clients, etc. There's really only two ways to get out of capital gains taxes. One is to lose money. And the other one is to die, because when you die under today's laws, your heirs get it what's known as a stepped up basis in the price of the stock. So they can sell it and pay little or no capital gains taxes on it. But you should check the cost basis on this appreciated asset because it may not be that bad, especially if it's in a stock based mutual fund in which you've been reinvesting dividends for many years. Because every time you get those dividends from the mutual fund and then put it back into the mutual fund, you still had to pay taxes on that if it was outside of a retirement account, a tax-sheltered retirement account. And so you've built up your cost basis on that, and therefore it's probably a lot higher than you can imagine. You might also want to look at your portfolio and see if you have some other losses in there that you could sell and use those to offset the gains from a taxation standpoint. And then finally, try to reduce the rate if you can. like I said, wait until the gains have reached long-term status if it's a larger dollar amount. And then it's possible to pay 0% capital gains tax as long as your income, your overall income, remains in the 15% federal income tax bracket. So that might mean selling some of your appreciated assets now and then waiting until after the first of the year in 2018 to sell more. Now, you are taking some market risk because there's a possibility it could go down in value over the next 5 months, but at least you will hopefully be able to stay in the 0% long-term capital gains tax bracket.
But at the end of the day, it's still hard to swallow those taxes pay up. So what do we do?
Yeah, here's a good mental exercise if you're in this situation. Go back about a year or so, and I'd be willing to bet if you've had a highly appreciated asset that the amount of money you made on that particular investment over the last year will probably pay your tax bill alone compared to what the price was a year ago. So you'll still net out how much the asset was worth a year ago. So and then keep in mind, if it falls a little bit or a lot, you'll be very happy that you sold now and did pay those little taxes, because then if you want, you can repurchase it, and the asset may have a higher cost basis at the time. Next week, we're going to talk to you about how you can use those appreciated assets to kind of support your charitable giving, support charities, but then also cut your tax bill and maybe even eliminate your taxes in a big way.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Do you have a question for financial planner Kevin McKinley? Join us in this discussion on Your Money, 800-642-1234. You can also post your financial questions for Kevin on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And we'll get to more of your money questions. There's a line open for you on the other side of this short break. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey, well, I need.
Ah, yes, dollar, indeed. Dollar. Kevin McKinley is here for On Your Money. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, your personal finance question, join us, 800-642-1234, or you can post your question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's now go to John in Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Hello. Hey, Kevin, I know you're not a tax expert, but I think you know the answer to this question. So based on your last conversation before the break, I was just thinking, let's say there's a particular mutual fund I own, and every year I'm taxed on capital gains and dividends, distributions related to that mutual fund. But then it also seems like if I were to sell that mutual fund, you know, 5 years down the road, it seems like I'm being taxed on all the gains again. So are you really kind of being double taxed on that, or am I missing something here?
No, that's a good question, John, and I see why you might why that might appear to be true, but really you're not, because what you're doing is, when in your situation, and it's a very common scenario, is you have, let's say, $10,000, and the mutual funds are generally required to pass out all their net distributions to you during the year as a shareholder. They have to give you, let's say it's $100. You have been saying, thank you for that $100. I would like that to be reinvested in new shares. So it's no different than if you just took $100 out of your checking account and bought new shares from a tax standpoint. Usually you get to do it at no load if you had a loaded fund, which is a nice deal. It does create a bit of a tax nightmare, because you've made all of these purchases over these years, and unless you've kept track of it, it's very difficult to go back and then figure out what the real cost basis is, especially if the mutual fund or the financial services company hasn't kept track of those for you. But no, you're only, once you get that $100 reinvestment, let's say, then you're only paying gains on whatever the $100 made, not on the $100 itself, if that makes sense.
John, thanks so much for the question. Let's now go to Kelly in Stevens Point. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have about $30,000 in student loans for my master's program, and I'm wondering, and it's about 6.5%, and I'm wondering if it makes sense to refinance into a private, like through a local credit union at like 2.5%, or if we had to lose the tax write-off and it wouldn't make sense.
Kelly, are these federal student loans that you have, or are they already private
yes.
loans? Okay.
No, well, they're like through Chase. But I think they're federal. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, if they're federal, I would keep them federal.
Okay.
And the reason being is that federal loans are easier to delay payment on if you run into some financial trouble. They're still, as of now, more likely to qualify for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. And generally, even when the rates are higher, the payment terms are better than with a private loan. The only time I would consolidate into this private loan is if the interest rate is remarkably different, you don't think that you're going to have any issue whatsoever paying these loans off, and you're sure that you won't qualify for any public service loan forgiveness programs. And even this 2.5%, I think, that you mentioned, Kelly, do you know if that's a fixed rate or if that's an adjustable rate?
I believe it was a fixed rate, yeah.
Okay.
I looked at the 10 years for the public service loan forgiveness.
Right.
And I'd only really benefit like $800 or something at the end of 10 years, so it wasn't worth it.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, you might want to look at doing that. You just want to make sure any fees that you're paying are very clear to you, if you're paying any upfront fees whatsoever. And at that interest rate, if it indeed is a fixed interest rate, you want to pay that off as slowly as you can possibly stand it. One of the things to think about, too, and we're going to talk about this in a few weeks, but when you are thinking about student loans, anybody out there taking them out, there's a natural inclination to take something out that's a shorter period loan, meaning something that's 5 years versus 10 or 10 versus 15. And remember that, yes, you will save on interest because you're paying it off over a shorter period of time, but your payment will be higher every single month, which is difficult for many people to meet, especially since they're just joining the workforce. And when you go to purchase a home, to get a mortgage, you're trying to get a car loan, one of the things the lender will look at is how much of your income is currently occupied by paying off other debt. And that higher student loan payment is going to keep you from getting some loans that you would otherwise get if you instead had a loan that were going out longer. And by law, most student loans can be paid off early with no penalty. So if you do get into really great shape and you don't want to pay the high interest rate or pay the interest over the long term of the loan, you can always pay it off early. But if you do run into trouble or you're going to be borrowing money in the future, it's probably better off to go with a longer term and keep your monthly payment more affordable.
Kelly, good luck on those student loans. Let's now go to Reshma in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Reshma. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I have been saving for my kids' college tuition through employee stock purchase plan. So I have quite a bit of stocks in my company at this time. My son is going to college this year, so I was wondering if I could gift him some of those stocks to lessen the capital gain on myself.
You can, but the cost basis, whatever your cost basis is, Reshma, it's going to be his new cost basis. And he might be in a lower income tax bracket, therefore a lower capital gains tax bracket than you. Is he applying for any need-based financial aid?
Not getting any of that.
Okay, that's good to know. As long as you're comfortable with him actually having control over the money, he's over 18, right? Or he will be soon.
He's over 18.
Okay. In theory, when you gift these investments to him, that's his money. He's free to do with it whatever he wants. And so as long as you're comfortable with the notion that he is going to actually not only sell the stocks, but use the proceeds as you would have intended, no, I'm fine with that. Like I said, the difference is that sometimes that can preclude him from getting need-based financial aid, because now it's his student asset, and it looks so much larger on the expected family contribution formula that schools use to award need-based financial aid. So if you're comfortable with all those things and the dollar amount, what would be the dollar amount of the stocks that you'd be giving him, Reshma?
So his tuitions are about $30,000 a year.
Okay.
So equivalent, that $30,000 a year is what we would be giving him.
Okay, by we, do you mean your spouse as well? Yeah, the reason I ask is because in theory, one American can only give another American $14,000 per year with no gift tax implications. And so what I would do is try to spread the gift out between right now and, again, after the first of the year, January 2nd of 2018, so that it's divided between two calendar years and you don't have to file any gift tax return.
Well, Reshma, good luck with that, and thanks for your call. And we've got a couple questions coming in, Kevin, about reverse mortgages. Rich in Huntley, Illinois, is with us. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I have a question about, I have a reverse mortgage. I've had it for about 4 years when I turned 62. But what I'm interested in, I've got a little savings and annuities and things like that. I'd like to start paying off some of that reverse mortgage. Is it better to pay principal or interest if you're trying to pay it off?
Yeah, Rich, let's talk a little bit for people who aren't familiar with reverse mortgages. Reverse mortgages are loans that people over 62 can get where they can borrow up to maybe about two-thirds of the equity they have established in their home. So if their home's worth $200,000 and it's paid for, they might be able to borrow about $160,000 or so in the form of a lump sum. It might be a home equity line of credit. It might be a monthly payment. And you don't have to pay that loan back. What happens is the loan keeps building up interest. And then when you leave the house, either vertically, you walk out of it, or horizontally, you're dead. The house is sold. And the proceeds from the reverse mortgage go to first pay off whatever the balance of the reverse mortgage is. And if there's anything left, Rich or Rich's estate gets the net amount. If the loan is larger than what the net proceeds are, nobody owes anything. Part of the fees and part of the insurance pays for the difference between those two. And Rich, my question to you is just why, first of all, why do you want to pay this off?
Well, I'm planning on selling and moving real soon. And I was just thinking how to manage that portfolio a little bit when I...
Okay. You just as soon get all the proceeds out of it?
Yes.
Okay. Is the mortgage, is it close to the value of the house, or is there still a lot of equity left in it?
There's still a lot of equity left.
Okay. I check with the lender and tell them you want to pay the mortgage off without actually selling the house so that you can do it. It'll happen automatically anyway. I mean, you won't be able to get the proceeds of the house until the reverse mortgage is paid off. But check with them and say, how can I pay this down? And not only that, but how can I make sure when I do send a dollar in, it's applied towards principal right away, which will reduce the amount. And I've never worked with anybody. I've worked with very few people who've actually had reverse mortgages, but I've never worked with anyone who's actually paid it off. So make sure you check with them to understand the process for it, but then also to know that if you do send dollars in, that it's going to the right place.
All right. Well, Rich, good luck. Thanks for your call. And we are talking with Kevin McKinley here with this edition of On Your Money. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, join us 800-642-1234. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. August is National Make-A-Will Month, and you should listen up, even if you already have one or don't think you need one. Why is this so important, Kevin? Oh, are you there, Kevin?
I am there. Are you there?
Yeah, we're there.
And it's not just because it's August that it's very important. According to Caring.com, only 42% of adults have a will. And only 36% of parents with kids under 18 have done any kind of estate planning at all. And I'm willing to bet from my professional experience that most of those people who do have a will, it probably hasn't been updated in quite a while. And it's not as much trouble or as expensive as you might think to get those correct estate planning documents in place. But what does happen is if you don't have those things in place and a tragedy befalls you, it's really expensive. Sometimes people think, geez, lawyers just want me to write a will so they don't have to come in and give them money. No, writing a will and setting up estate planning documents really isn't a lucrative business for most estate planning attorneys. What's really lucrative is when people with assets, with kids, with liabilities in complex situations die without doing any estate planning at all.
So this will is this piece of paper that says where your assets should go if you die.
Right. And it's not just stuff. It also appoints executors for a person to handle your estate. And it talks about who should get what and when. But also, as part of the estate planning process, you should consider what to do if, or what should be done if you're alive but you're unable to make decisions on your own, or if you have other family members who are relying on your love and support or your income, what should happen to them and how they should be cared for.
And what happens if a person dies without a will?
Usually the state law determines what happens, and it might not be according to your wishes, and it depends on sometimes who really makes the most noise about, you know, wanting to be the executor, wanting part of your estate, wanting to take care of your kids. It will definitely take more time and money to settle it if you don't have a will in place, and costing way more than it does now to do it preemptively. And even if, like I said, if you have a will and you wrote it a long time ago, I can just about guarantee your life has changed. You probably need some things along with that estate planning process that you haven't set up as well.
So like what? What are we talking about here?
Well, you might want, or you might need, a trust in place that can kind of catch your assets and still be managed for somebody, specifically if you have young children who will inherit an estate if something happens to you and the other children's parent. Life insurance can be, you know, $500,000 or $1 million. You don't want that to go to an 18-year-old, especially one who doesn't have a parent in place to help them manage that money. You might want to make sure that the beneficiaries of all your accounts are updated, like your not only your life insurance, but also your retirement accounts, any charitable requests that you've just recently thought of. And then these two are the most important ones: healthcare directives and then powers of attorney, people who, again, can take over for you if you are alive but unable to make decisions about your day-to-day business, like paying your bills, or for healthcare issues, like deciding, you know, what treatments should be made and what shouldn't.
And this sounds like a lot of detail work. How much will it cost to get a proper estate plan in place?
You can use some online services like LegalZoom or Novo.com to do things on your own, and those are generally legal. But you should really only consider those if you have a very, very simple situation. I'm talking about maybe a single person who doesn't have a lot of debt outstanding nor a lot of assets. Anything more complex, you definitely want to talk to an attorney, and specifically someone who is trained and specializes in estate planning. Again, for a relatively simple situation, you can plan on spending somewhere between $500 and $2,000 to get everything in place. And then you should revisit that usually about every 5 years, because as I mentioned, that's about the time period where either the laws change or something in your life has changed that necessitates you take another look at your estate planning.
And how do we go about finding an attorney?
Talk to other people who would know in your life. You can talk to you know, financial advisor. If you have a tax preparer, definitely talk to them. Talk to friends or family in the same region you're living in, because you'd like to do this face-to-face if you can. But then you can also go online at avvo.com, 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 to search for an attorney in a particular specialty in a particular geographic area. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And it is On Your Money, where your financial questions are front and center. 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation there. Let's go to Billy in Sparta. Hi, Billy.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So we're wondering, we have, our son has just turned 8, and he's covered by the GI Bill, so he'll get to go to school on the state, I guess. And we're looking at putting away money for living expenses while he's in college, because, of course, that's not covered. And right now we have an Edward Jones account with a couple of mutual funds that we just invest in. Is that the best option for doing that, or is there something we should be doing better? Because it seems very slow-growing at best.
It depends on the kind of investments. If it's relatively conservatively invested, that's just going to happen. It's going to be slow growing, but hopefully slow falling or slowly receding in during tough times. And it's not so much that I'm concerned about the actual investments inside, Billy. It's the nature of the account. Is this an account that you and your wife have in your names, or is it in your son's name, or is it a 529 college savings account?
It's not a 529, but it's in, I guess, all three of our names.
Okay, so I'm guessing you're set up as the custodians for the account, and then you've used your son's Social Security number to open it, right?
Yes.
Okay. There's good and bad news about doing that. The good news is that any gains in the account are probably going to be taxed at a lower rate, because they're going to be taxed at his rate. The bad news about it is that As we mentioned before, when he goes to apply for any need-based financial aid, the school and the financial aid office are going to consider this much more strongly than if you had kept the money in your own name or in a 529 plan. And the other bad news about this is technically, since it is his money, once he reaches the age of majority, which can be from 18 to usually 21, depending on the state, this is his money, and he gets to do with it whatever he wants. And legally, you can't stop him from doing it. Now, many parents just... they choose to spend this money on other things that they can while the child is a teenager, like a car, computer, summer camp, band lesson, something like that, so that they can exhaust it and then use money they otherwise would have spent on that, on those expenditures, to fund a 529 plan so that they can take back control of the money. And that's legal to do that. In terms of growing it, you have to remember, he's eight. He's going to probably be using this when he's 18, and it's going to be exhausted in a relatively short period of time. Hopefully, he only is in college for 4 or 5 years. So with asset prices near all-time highs, I'm actually okay with this being kind of conservative, especially, are you adding to this, Billy, like every month, maybe putting in $100 or something like that, or was this just a one-time deposit?
Yeah, no, we add to it every month, and then we had a couple CDs, and when those mature, we throw those in there too.
Okay. I'm fine with that, and I like the dollar cost averaging for it, because then you'll buy fewer shares when prices are high and more shares when prices are lower. So, yeah, I'm okay with that. I'd recommend, though, that you switch to the 529 account for the reasons that we've just discussed. What happens is you will then maintain control of the 529 account, and you'll get a little tax break on it if you use Wisconsin's EdVest account. And then if the money is used for qualified higher education expenses, which room and board do count in that, it's tax-free when it comes out. But if your son either doesn't go to college or you decide he's not worthy of that support for whatever reason, you don't have to give that money to him.
Okay. Well, what happens to it then?
You can do with it whatever you want. You can pass it on to another family member. You can leave it in there until he comes to his senses and decides to go back to school. You can also pull it out, and if you do pull it out that time, you'll pay taxes on the earnings portion, which you would have paid taxes on it anyway under if you'd had the money yourself, and plus it'll be a 10% penalty on the earnings portion.
Well, Billy, good luck there, and thanks for calling in. Let's get another call here. We were talking about wills earlier, Chris. Let's go to now Chris in Watertown.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Chris.
Hi. I've talked to a friend of mine about this, and I want to protect my cats when I die, and I want to include them in my will. And can I put them in my will to be protected? And I'm living in Wisconsin now. I may be moving to Colorado and set aside money for a future caretaker. And my executor would oversee finding a good caretaker and money for their care.
All right. Well, Kevin, what do we know about that?
I think it's a great question. It's something we're actually going to talk about in a few weeks. But right, because many of us, more people own some form of pet who don't, and many of us, we may have, even if you have children or family members you're concerned about, they can take care of themselves usually, and the pets can't. And so it's actually been addressed already by the legal profession. They've come up with things called pet trusts, which talks about which pets are covered by this. It names a caretaker. It leaves a specific amount of money to be used for the pet care, and describes how it should be cared for. And then there's even a person in there who's supposed to kind of watch things to make sure that the person taking care of the pets actually is doing so. And it really is, you wonder what happens to these animals, and it's no different than caring for children. The difference is you'd hope with the children, eventually they'll age into independence, whereas, sure, the dogs and cats can hunt for themselves, but that goldfish is stuck in the bowl. He or she is like, come on, I've waited for hours here to be fed, and I can't exactly forage with this little ceramic castle you drop down in this bowl to look for more food. So having that in place, I think, is very comforting to the owner to know if something happens to me, that these pets are going to be cared for, and I've set up money so that it's not a financial burden to whomever's agreed to do it. So, yeah, talk to an attorney. Go to avvo.com. Talk to an estate planning attorney, and I guarantee, Chris, you will not be the first person who has approached that attorney with this notion of how do I care for my pets after I'm gone.
Good luck, Chris, and thanks for calling in. It is On Your Money. We're getting to your important money questions this hour at 800-642-1234. Kevin McKinley is here. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. We'll have more after this short break here on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around.
You're listening to On Your Money here on the Joy Cardine Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Joy. Kevin McKinley is here. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your personal finance question for Kevin at 800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Post that money-related question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin, there's this rare special event happening on Monday, August 21st, but you might want to start preparing for it right now. What is going on?
It is the total solar eclipse, be visible only in North America and only for a couple minutes or so. And the last one that was this visible was 38 years ago. Parade Magazine says the last one that tracked as well and was so focused on the United States was 1,500 years ago. The next one will be coming in 2024, but it will be in a much smaller viewing area. It's going to go up kind of through the eastern side of the United States. So this is one that most Americans will probably be able to see better than any other in their lifetimes.
What's the best way to view this eclipse?
Well, be in the right place. The best location is in a band that kind of goes from Oregon to South Carolina. It's about 70 miles wide and 2,000 miles long. But in our broadcast area down in southern Illinois, that's probably the closest place to Wisconsin that people can go to see it and get the absolute best viewpoint of it. I think they're even doing something at Southern Illinois University where they'll have an events out there and in the stadium. So that's probably the closest one to most of the viewers in our area.
And why are we talking about this in the Shop Around segment?
Because you cannot experience anything, Kate, unless you have to buy stuff for it, right? All right. So now you can watch it online and several people will be broadcasting it. You can do that old thing. I don't know if you were a kid, but I remember when this happened when I was a kid, the teacher said, oh, no, we're going to go outside. We're going to go look at this partial eclipse. And don't look at the sun, kids. And because we were in a gifted and talented school, so they had to tell us to not stare at the sun. but then we did this thing with the pinhole and the cardboard.
Yep.
And all I saw was a stupid dot on a piece of cardboard. There was nothing majestic about that. So I would like, since this may be the last solar eclipse I see in my lifetime, I'd like to see it as well as I could. So you have to buy special glasses for this, and only 5 different brands have actually been certified as they will truly be safe to use to view the eclipse. And you can go on Amazon.com and buy 5 cheap cardboard ones for $10. You can buy 3 nicer ones for $16, and you can buy one that will double the perspective for about $10. If you're planning on taking pictures of this, you need a special camera filter, or if you're going to look at it through a telescope or binoculars, you need special filters on those as well. Now, again, because this is such a rare event, it's something that if you plan on viewing it, you probably want to buy this stuff now. So we'll put a link up to some of those purchases at onyourmoney.com later on today so that you can get your gear before the eclipse and before it runs out.
And not to mention the gas to get to your destination and perhaps the overnight stay. It will
add
up.
That's right. Eclipses are expensive. It's a good thing. They only happen once in a while.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-642-1234 with Irene in Cedarburg. Hi, Irene.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. McKinley, I have a question. I have a compulsory withdrawal from my IRA. I'm 75 years old, and I don't need all that money to live on. I'm very frugal. But what can I do with this money where it wouldn't disappear for a longer lifetime?
You mean you want to stop taking it out of the IRA? Is that what you're
no,
saying?
No, I would like. I have to take it out, and right. I do know that. But I would like to know where can I put this money that my a reserve into something else.
Sure. Do you have other investments, Irene, outside of the IRA already?
Yes, I do. I have a bank account.
Okay. Yeah, the bank account is not a bad place if you don't need it and you want to keep it safe. Again, a long-term certificate of deposit at that specific bank is a good idea. Again, it'll pay about 2% probably if you're willing to go out for 5 years. Just check the penalty for early withdrawal. If you want some kind of growth and some kind of risk, I wouldn't necessarily suggest that, especially if you don't really need the money right now, then you probably don't need the growth as well. You can try investing it in the stock market. Try to find a financial advisor or go to a place like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity who will help you over the phone or online to invest that amount. But keep in mind, anytime you're trying to get more return, you're taking on more risk. So you have to be comfortable that there could be loss in that, especially when you'd be investing at what is the equivalent of all-time highs for many different stock indices.
Well, Irene, good luck, and thanks for calling in. Let's now go to Pat in Madison. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good morning. The Social Security Administration has on their web page that in 2034, they may only be taking in enough taxes, payroll taxes, to be able to pay 79% of scheduled benefits. And I was just wondering, Kevin, if you would know that, whether that means that people who are already receiving Social Security at that time would have their benefit cut by 21%, or would that be for new applicants beginning in 2034?
My guess, Pat, is if indeed that does come to fruition. See, what's happening right now is they're taking more money in than they're paying out, and they've accumulated a surplus in Social Security that's, I think something like $2.4 trillion. It's a ton of money. But the problem is that as people age and collect Social Security and there are fewer workers in the workplace and the people aren't earning as much, there are fewer people paying in dollars enough to support that. And under today's projections, you're right. What they're saying is in 17 years, they'll have to cut benefits down to 79%. My guess, Pat, is it's just going to be a pay-as-you-go situation, which means that for every dollar that comes into Social Security, it'll go out right away to the form of benefits to somebody else. But 17 years is a long time, and I don't think it's going to be politically popular to cut Social Security benefits 21%. For current recipients just to make the system whole. And I'm guessing this has happened before. And what happened is they figured out a way to change the way benefits were paid and the way that they were taxed so that it would be an extremely gradual process to hopefully make Social Security whole and solvent again, meaning that both beneficiaries and recipients wouldn't really feel it. It's not like they said, gee, we got $2,000 this month, now we got $1,600 in the current month. But in the sense that they'll just gradually tweak it so that they can still get people what they're hopefully counting on.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for calling in at 800-642-1234 on this edition of On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley. He can answer your personal finance question, can take a crack at it, 800-642-1234. Let's now go to Kathy in Muskego. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got received $3,500 from my dad's estate, and the lawyer that settled the estate or closed the estate out mentioned that we were going to get a Schedule K. How does that work? Does that go on my income then, and I have to pay taxes on that, or can I reinvest it into my 401k that I have?
Is it a
to avoid that?
Is it a K-1?
I'm not sure what he said.
Okay, K-1, K-2, whatever it takes. Okay, yeah, well, if it is taxable, and this is part of settling the estate, usually if there's a trust involved with it, which is often the case, if it is taxable to you for income, sometimes that's deducted out in advance, but you can't avoid any type of distribution from an estate that is taxable. You can mitigate it somewhat by saying, well, I'm not going to take it right now, or I'm going to spread it out. Or you can do what you said, which you can say, all right, I've got some money that's going to be taxable for me. I'm going to bump up my contributions to pre-tax plans like 401ks, 403bs, or IRAs to offset the taxation that I would otherwise have to pay on this inheritance.
Well, good luck, Kathy, with that, and thanks for calling in. Let's go to Sherry now in Elkhorn. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about health savings accounts. I do not have one. I am 65, going to be 66 in the end of June. I just got a part-time job that offers the ability to have a health savings account, and I'm wondering if I should be contributing to that so that that will help me pay for my extra insurance that I'm going to need besides Medicare. And will it roll over? Do I stand to lose any of it at the end of the year or anything like that?
Now, the HSA is not a use-it-or-lose-it proposition. What happens is when you make contributions to it as part of a high-deductible plan, health insurance plan coverage, you get a tax break on the contributions. It's just like an IRA. If you contribute $1,000 to an HSA, you reduce your taxable income by $1,000 in the year of the contribution. Then, when you incur qualified medical expenses, you can pull money out of that HSA tax-free to meet those expenses or to pay your deductible that you are incurring until you actually reach the maximum on your deductible. And if you delay enrolling in Medicare, you can continue to put the money into the HSA as well. And it's not a, like I said, it's not a use it or lose it proposition. So if you do put into it, all you're really going to do is cut your taxes a little bit. And then that money is yours to use as you see fit. And even if you don't use it for qualified medical expenses tax-free, you can treat it like an IRA after reaching 65. You can pull it out for any reason whatsoever and pay taxes on it just as if you were pulling the money out of an IRA.
Well, thank you so much, Sherry, for that question. And we have a listener email here as we round out the hour, Kevin. I'm 61, the listener writes. My wife is 59. We want to retire. We've been in the Wisconsin retirement system for more than 35 years. We have approximately $1 million in the Wisconsin retirement system account. My wife has $675,000. We also have a joint retirement account with $385,000. When should we access Social Security benefits?
Social Security, if you have that money in the state pension, and it really is, you're probably going to get a nice size check right now. And if that covers your basic expenses, you probably want to delay taking Social Security. For most people, it's best to delay taking Social Security as long as you don't have to pull any money out of your own personal savings. Meaning, if you had a few hundred thousand dollars, and your choice is either tap Social Security or gradually pull that $200,000 down into nothing and then take Social Security, I'd rather have you take Social Security now. So as long as you can live on that money that you're getting from the state retirement, I'm okay with delaying Social Security until age 70.
And now it's time for the website of the week, Kevin.
We talked about estate planning and how difficult it is for many people to have the proper documents in place. There's a really neat website out there. It's GYST.com, GYST.com, and that's an acronym for Getting Your S Together. And it was founded by it's a great name. I love it. They just can't say what the S stands for. It was founded by a woman who was very young and lost her husband when she had absolutely no idea that this could happen and was not prepared for it by any stretch of the imagination. So she decided, I'm going to put this out there so other people can prepare in advance so that they don't have the same problems. GYST.com. We'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin, great to talk to you again.
You too, Kate.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard live Tuesday mornings at 8 and on the Ideas Network with a rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This hour was produced by Bill Martins. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.